Welcome to Being the Passion with hosts Todd Foster, Alyssa Stanley, and Kelly Scar. Today, we get to sit down with Doug Knoll, who has an incredible story. He was born nearly deaf, blind, crippled with two club feet, and he often mentions that he was also left-handed. But despite this, he learned how to read, and he ultimately became a lawyer, then turned peacemaker. He's a best-selling author of four books, speaker, visionary, and educator. He is the co-founder of Prison of Peace, which trains murderers in maximum security prisons how to be peacemakers and meditators in their prison communities. We're super excited to sit and talk about this because this is a conversation I don't know that any of us have ever had. Thank you for sitting with us today.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely, Doug. Well, again, thank you for agreeing to be, you know, sitting down with the three of us crazies here today. Really want to get some insight as to who you are, what you're about. So maybe you could give us kind of break it down for us, you know, give us the Cole's Notes version of Doug Knoll.
Well, all right, I'll try to keep this as short as possible. I've been living for 71 years and a lot of road under the wheels. I grew up in Southern California in affluence, and unfortunately, I was born with a lot of disabilities. I was born nearly blind, partially deaf, two club feet, left-handed, bad teeth. I got in the wrong line for everything except intellect, and I was a pretty smart kid. The problem was that because I was blind, or almost blind, that I was way behind in school until the fourth grade when some school nurse had the bright idea to test my vision. And they figured out that my vision was 2400, got me Coke lens glasses, which in the 1950s, of course, was a buzzkill, big, thick plastic glasses, you know, I mean, really thick. But that first summer after I got my glasses, I advanced three grade levels. And I'll never forget the head librarian at our city library called my mom and said, he's in the adult section. I can't have him in here. And she said, oh, the heck you can't. You let him go wherever he wants to go and read whatever he wants to read. So that's how it started. My problem with all my disabilities was that in the 1950s, I wasn't so disabled that, you know, I needed special care, but I did need emotional support. And my parents had no idea how to do that. And so I had a pretty miserable childhood. But I did well in school and ended up going to Dartmouth College and then came back from New Hampshire and then went back after college. I took a year off and then entered law school in California and graduated from law school in 1977, Law Review, Honor Society, all that stuff. And then I ended up clerking for a judge, an appellate judge in Central California. And then in 1978, joined a commercial litigation and bankruptcy firm as a young associate, and they hired me and groomed me to be a trial lawyer. And that's exactly what happened. 2 months later, I tried my first jury trial. And 2 months after that, I found myself in San Diego, California, co-chairing the defense of a $36 million securities fraud case in federal court. And for the next 22 years, that's what I did. I tried cases. In the 1980s, I picked up the martial arts, which I was really bad at for a long time. But that is really kind of my story, is that I'm really bad at something. If I decide to do something, I'm going to be really bad at it for a long time. And then one day I'll wake up and I'll have it mastered. And that's what happened in the martial arts. I was really bad at it for a long time, but ultimately I got my black belt and then I got my secondary black belt. And after I got my second degree, my teacher fired me. Too arrogant, too much of an asshole, too dangerous. You know, trial lawyer, secondary black belt, five guys with knives. Nope, not a problem. And he said, go learn Tai Chi. And that was really probably the pivotal event of my life at that time. I was in my early 40s, started studying Tai Chi. And there were two paradoxes that I had to master. The first is the softer you are, the stronger you are. And the second is the more vulnerable you are, the more powerful you are. So it was soft to be strong, vulnerable to be powerful, completely antithetical to everything that I believed in as a trial lawyer and martial artist. But I kept studying Tai Chi as a martial art and learned that, number one, it's the oldest martial art, and two, it's very vicious, extremely vicious, even more vicious than the first art I was schooled in. And then one day, some years later, I was in a courtroom trying a case, and the thought came to me, what the heck am I doing in here? And after that trial, I was had a vacation planned on a whitewater trip up in Idaho with friends. And I was sat for 10 days as sitting on my raft, all by myself on my raft, powering through these big rapids, rowing through these rapids, thinking about how many people I'd really served as a trial lawyer. I could only come up with 5 people after I'd done hundreds of cases. And I said, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. I don't want to go another 30 years and only serve 20 or 30 people. My calling is bigger than that. So didn't know what I was going to do. Came back home, drove out of the mountains to my office. And as I was driving in, I heard what turned out to be the only public service announcement, the one and only public service announcement for a new master's degree program in peacemaking and conflict studies being offered at Fresno Pacific University. And it caught my attention. And ultimately, I enrolled. And for a period of 3 years, I was a full-time master's degree student in my late 40s. In my late 40s, a 3/4 time law professor and a full-time trial lawyer. It was pretty crazy. But I ultimately graduated, and my partners and I could never agree on what a new practice would look like with this idea of being peacemaking and problem solving. And so I just walked out. I gave a week's notice, left $10 million on the table, and just walked out of the firm. And in November 1st, 2000, started my peacemaking and mediation business. And since that time, I've been basically in our world, we would call it an ADR professional. I'm a neutral. So I arbitrate, mediate. Of course, I do a lot of teaching and training. I've written 4 books, and we can get into the Prison of Peace Project, which was another major project of mine. And I developed a unique set of de-escalation skills where I can teach people how to calm any angry person in 90 seconds or less. And that, of course, is the title of my 4th book.
Amazing. I'm just so looking forward to this conversation. This is going to be a awesome. I do want to back up for 1 second and ask you a question about your self-awareness. Like, where did that come from? Was it developed early on? Did it take you 40 years to become self-aware and understand what your strengths and weaknesses were and get that, pivotal understanding that you knew that you were going to suck at something for a long period of time before you mastered it? Was this something that was just always in you, or was it something that you consciously developed in yourself?
Evolved over decades. I was fortunate that my parents exposed me to a lot of really cool things as a kid. We started backpacking in 1956 before anybody knew what backpacking was. I learned how to ski in 1958, even though my legs were a mess. And obviously, I was way behind in athleticism, but I was also stubborn and tenacious. And the doctor said, you'll never be able to do this. And I said, yeah. So whenever anybody said in my life, you can't do this, it was like putting a red flag in front of a bull, right? And I would go out and do it just to prove them wrong. And in the beginning, it was compensation, of course. Psychological compensation for all of the disability. But eventually I learned how to learn, and I really loved learning. And I learned something pretty early on, and that was to always be a beginner at something, because that keeps you humble. My self-awareness developed later in life. And I was really arrogant. I had a lot of insecurities. I was an emotional mess, like most people. And I didn't really... Even though I had a deep spiritual practice, I was searching for the wrong thing in the wrong way. And it wasn't until I started really focusing on emotions that I started developing emotional self-awareness, self-regulation, and empathy. And it was that process over a period of probably 10 years that allowed me to grow out of my emotional disabilities as well as my physical disabilities. And I learned how to do it. And that allowed me to be able to teach other people to do what I did without having to go through everything I went through. I shortcut the process.
So let me go back to 4th grade. You're a 4th grader, club feet, left-handed, Coke bottle glasses. You probably were like the ladies' band back then, like you still are.
I wish.
Hey, those women right now are thinking, man, I had that chance and I didn't take it. Yet, have you looked back on that experience and you said almost like you're a bully, right? You are a bully there. It sounded like you were egotistical. You're kind of hateful just because of everything that's been had happened to you in life. Do you believe that at any time you felt like a prisoner in your own body?
Oh.
And that's why you're going towards the prisoner peace route?
No, I don't think so. I was never a bully. I was never violent or push people around. I was arrogant and full of myself and knew everything and nobody could tell me anything, right? So I had that problem. I never felt like I was a prisoner in my own body. The Prisoner of Peace Project started as for something different. And that is, one, it sounded like a really deep test of who I was as a human being to teach murderers to be peacemakers. And two, it was going to offer me an opportunity to acid test some of these de-escalation skills that I had been developing. And, you know, we started the Prison of Peace Project when I was 60 years old. So I was no spring chicken going into this thing. And it, you know, it's turned out to be an amazing project. Amazing. Beyond amazing.
Do you feel like you found happiness finally at the age of 60, or were you happy before then?
I think I found happiness at about age 54, 55. Finally. Took me that long, 5.5 decades, to find true happiness. And for those who are seeking happiness and are really unhappy in their lives, I'll tell you what it is. It's not about the money. It's about service to others. Learning how to serve others in a meaningful way. And that doesn't mean you have to do something big like be a Mother Teresa. You can learn how to serve one person at a time. It's what I call listening people into existence. And once you learn that, you get this sense of pure joy in life because your life has meaning. What did Viktor Frankl say? He said, the meaning of life is to serve others. It's true. And that is absolutely true.
I find this absolutely fascinating because especially in the coaching practice, a lot of times it's a misconception that you somewhat listen, but you essentially tell the recipient what they should do and give them all kinds of advice. And the last practice is actually listening to those that are sitting across the table, because the more you allow someone to speak, the more self-discovery happens. And when self-discovery happens, that's when real change actually occurs. It's not necessarily the recommendations that we give or what we tell them that they should do. It's them being able to speak and us truly listening on a deeper level. So being able to listen on a deeper level takes a lot of time and development. That's really not something that you're taught in school, right? So
it doesn't take a lot of time and effort to learn how to listen deeply. I can teach anybody how to do this in about 4 weeks. If they're willing to put in a couple of hours of practice a week, they can totally master deep listening in 4 to 6 weeks. It's knowing what to listen for and how to reflect. That's the secret. And it's all based on brain science. It's a process known as affect labeling. And what you're actually, it's a three-step process. Number one, ignore the words. Number two, read the emotional data fields. And number three, reflect back the emotional experience, or reflect that emotional data back to the speaker with a you statement, no I statements. And it's that simple. Now, it's easy to talk about. It takes a little bit of courage to do this because it's so counter-normative and counterintuitive to what we think we know about each other. What? I'm going to tell you how you feel? Isn't that weird or manipulative or patronizing or rude? It's not. It's not. Brain science, there's not 15 brain scanning studies from 2007 forward that demonstrate that when you listen to people's emotions, you are literally lending them your prefrontal cortex. And during that 30 to 90 seconds, their emotional centers, their emotional neural networks are being inhibited, and the ventral lateral prefrontal cortex, the executive function in our brains, is being activated. And very briefly, the science behind this is that when people get emotional, it overwhelms their prefrontal cortex. They can no longer think clearly. We've all had this experience. We know this. And for reasons that are still not clear, although we can see it in the fMRI studies, that when we label somebody else's feelings, label their emotions for them, we tell them what they're feeling, it helps their brain regain equilibrium. And it happens very quickly, 30 to 90 seconds. Now, when I first discovered this in 2005, I was sort of blown away by what I saw, had no idea what was really going on, knew what I did. And then it was in 2007 when Lieberman's first study came out. And I had a lot of skepticism. And that's why one of the reasons why I wanted to do the Prison of Peace project with my dear friend Laurel Coffer is because we're going to walk into the most violent women's prison in the world and teach murderers how to be peacemakers. And the first thing we're going to teach them is how to listen other people into existence. And it worked beyond our wildest dreams.
How do you actually listen to someone's emotions? Because our society's trained to listen to words, listen to directions. How do you listen to emotions?
We have an innate ability to accurately, efficiently, and quickly read each other's emotions. This is something that evolved in hominids over millions of years. Remember that we've only had language or the vocabulary for only less than 230,000 years. And there was a huge evolutionary, it occurred at about the same time that hominids mastered fire, because when fire was mastered, then animal protein and animal fat could be consumed. And that added a huge bunch of calories to the diets, which allowed for a rapid expansion of the brain and a super rapid expansion of the pharyngeal nerves and muscles, which control the tongue and face. And that's when all of a sudden now we developed from an evolutionary perspective, the ability to speak. Before that, for millions of years, there was no vocabulary. There was no speech. So how did humans communicate? They communicated through their emotions, through emotional expressions, through grunts, sub-vocalizations. Well, our brains are hardwired to read that data because that's the only way we communicated and survived for millions of years. And most people don't know that. And of course, for 4,000 years, we've been taught that emotions are bad, they're evil, they're irrational. We've been taught by theologians and philosophers that what separates men from other animals is rationality. Totally false. There's not one ounce of truth to that. We are not rational. We are emotional. We're 98% emotional and 2% rational. We can't even be rational unless we're emotional first. And this is all what neuroscience is teaching us over the last 20 years. It's taking classical economic theory, for example, and turned it on its head. Although there were, you know, people like Kahneman and Tversky were figuring this all out back in the 80s and 90s, but it took neuroscience to figure out what's going on here. And so the whole concept of rationality as it was developed by von Neumann and Morgenstern in 1944 in their classical postulations of economic theory turns out to be completely false. And today in economics, for example, you've got behavioral economics, you've got neuroeconomics, you've got people who are looking at how people really make decisions, not how they should make decisions. What we're looking at is descriptive versus normative practice. And once you understand that, once you get the insight that we're 98% emotional, then listening to emotions becomes a very normal, essential thing to do. But if we continue to focus on the words and think that people are rational in their decision-making and in their processing, then all we're going to do is hit our heads against the wall. Because we're going to be just time and time and time again, we'll give advice or we'll help people elicit information for themselves, like you were talking about, Alyssa, and they won't do it. They'll do something completely different, opposite. And you shake your head, what's wrong with these people? But once you start recognizing that they're emotional and not rational, then their behaviors become completely predictable. And your interventions as a coach become much, much more effective because you're reaching them where they really are, not where we think they are. And that's the difference.
So is this the foundation of the latest book, of which I actually just downloaded the Kindle from Amazon, by the way?
Yes.
Deescalate How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. So can you kind of, you know, maybe expand on that just a little bit for us?
Sure. So the book came about as a request from my incarcerated students. Hundreds of them knew that I was an author. I'd written 3 books. And they asked me to write a book about this process that we were teaching so they could share it with their families. So I did. And the book was, I wrote it in 6 weeks. My agent, we sold it to Simon & Schuster, got a term sheet from Simon & Schuster, Beyond Words, Atria, in, that would have been November of 2017. I gave him the final manuscript at the end of Thanksgiving. My agent gets a call in February of 2018, and the president of Atria read the manuscript and asked, how fast can we get this book out? And they got it out in less than 7 months.
Wow.
But the book talks about these skills. It talks about the neuroscience. It talks about this concept of affect labeling and emotional invalidation. And then it takes us to the arc of life. How do we use these skills in wherever we are in our life? And what I learned since writing the book is that it's not just about calming people down. It's about creating emotional safety for people in really deep and profound ways. And when you deeply validate somebody in the way that I teach, they feel deeply heard. They feel deeply validated and feel deeply understood in ways that they have never experienced before. Most people have never experienced before in their lives. And this is not only my personal experience, but the experience of the thousands and thousands of people that I've taught and coached how to do this, including people incarcerated.
So with the Prisoner of Peace Project, you're speaking to these people and they're realizing that most of the things we all do in life are based on emotions. And those people, unfortunately, took an emotion and went a different way with it than most people do. At this point at all, over the time you've been doing this, have people come clean about their murders or whatever they're in prison for? Or have they seen a light at the end of the tunnel? Or how are they reacting once they discover all this?
We made the conscious decision going in that we would never talk about what crimes they committed. Although we knew working with a lifer population that it was homicide of some kind or another, somebody died. And as we got more and more experience, we started going into darker and darker places. And then before the pandemic hit, I was working at Corcoran State Prison in California, which is the highest security prison in California. I was teaching 100 feet away from Charles Manson's cell, working with men who were coming out of gangs, and they were all tatted up, brutal murderers, but they were rejecting gangs. What happens to a couple of observations? One, I observe that murderers are bred, not born, for the most part. So if you grew up in an extremely emotional, dysfunctional family with nothing but anger and no emotional support at all, then the likelihood of you becoming a criminal is very high. I'll never forget when we were talking about family of origin with these guys, and I said, "Well, what were the dominant emotions in your family?" And then one guy said, "The only emotion in my family was violent anger. That's the only thing I knew from the time I could begin to understand." And of course, if that's what you're learning, that's what you're going to become. But what happens is, as we teach them these skills, not only we teach them over 250 skills in the Prison of Peace Project to turn them into powerful peacemakers and mediators, is that they regain their humanity. They learn that violence is one choice for resolving conflict, but there are a lot of other choices as well. They learn that listening deeply to somebody is probably the go-to skill to solve just about every problem that arises in a prison community. They get in touch with their own emotions. They become emotionally competent. And as they become emotionally competent, they automatically turn away from their old way of thinking to a new way of thinking. And amazingly enough, many of them who never thought they would get out of prison have been released because of the transformations they made in their own lives. And the other thing I can say with a lot of pride is of the thousands of inmates that we've trained that have been released on parole, there's not one report that we're aware of that anybody has reoffended. Zero recidivism. That's how powerful it is. It is amazing. And that's why the Department of Correction and Rehabilitation gives us a lot of funding, because the department recognizes that we're expensive, but we're effective.
Has the prison population experienced a culture shift since then? Are there less internal activities?
Yes. Now, when we go into an institution, it depends, you know, in California, there are over 60 different prison facilities of one kind or another. Typically, they're divided into yards. A typical men's prison will have four different yards, and each yard will contain anywhere between 900 and 1,000 men. We'll go in and only work in one yard at a time, and we'll work in yards where we're welcome. For example, at Pleasant Valley State Prison in Coalinga, California, the administration offered Prison of Peace to 1 yard, and the gang leader said, no, they don't want it because they were afraid that we would usurp their power. So we went into a different yard. And what we have found is that it takes us generally 3 years to build a sustainable program where we got people who are inmates who are trainers and they train other people. And so they don't need our presence anymore. We find, however, that when we have trained about 3 to 4% of the population in a yard, the yard culture changes and it becomes less violent. Not to say that it eliminates all violence, but it becomes much, much less violent. In fact, we got that first prison we worked in, Valley State Prison for Women, we got a letter from the warden 2 years in saying that they could no longer call this the largest, most violent women's prison in the world. The place had completely quieted down as a result of the work that the women serving life sentences who became leaders and peacemakers had done to quiet the yard down, stop the violence.
Do you see a difference in adoption between the men's prisons and the women's prisons? Do women's prisons adopt this rather quickly and stick with it, or there's no difference whatsoever?
The only difference is the men are easier to train than the women. And that's not that's not because of a gender difference. That's because of the men's prisons tend to be more homogenous in terms of the type of person that's in a prison. In the women's prisons, there are only two women's prisons, or two and a half really, in California. And so a woman who is in prison for a life sentence for three strikes because she stole Twinkies to feed her baby could be bunking with a serial murderer. That would not happen in a men's prison. And so the men are easier to teach, not because of gender-based, but because we see the same kind of population. So if I'm in Corcoran and I'm working in 4 Yard, which is the secured housing unit, deepest security, you know, that you can imagine, and I'm dealing with gangbangers, they're all gangbangers. So I know what I got. You know, if I'm working in a level 2 yard in a men's prison, which is a much less secure place, the security precautions are much less. I know what I got. I got the men are all basically, I mean, they're very diverse, I think, in every way you can imagine, except that their propensity for violence and so forth is going to be pretty much the same. With a women's prison, you don't get that. So you can have mentally ill women in the yard. You can have with cognitive deficits, with educational deficits, all kinds of stuff. And they're all mixed together, which makes teaching them much more challenging.
Is there commonality in the way that they were brought up between the men and the women? You had mentioned something about violence in the home and that sort of thing, and those types of emotions. Is that kind of a common theme between the genders?
Universal. We have one young woman who told us her story. I'll just very briefly repeat it. She told us that she was raped by her uncles when she was 4 years old. She was addicted to heroin by her mother when she was 7. Her mother started prostituting her when she was 12. She killed her first man at 13, killed her second man at 14, and then was, as a juvenile, was sentenced to prison for life without possibility of parole and said prison's the safest place she's ever been in her life. That's a very common story. That is a very, very common story.
Have you considered, or are there plans to move this into maybe juvenile facilities or maybe even high school so that you can catch it before it explodes?
We've tried both. We got a grant to try to work in a juvenile facility in Los Angeles County. It was a complete failure. It was a complete failure for a lot of reasons, not because of our curriculum, but because we did not have the support of the institution. The institution itself was completely dysfunctional, and trying to teach this to 17-year-old boys who are only interested in drugs and when they're going to get laid next and, you know, when they're going to get out and be with their gang again. That's all they're interested in at 17. Very difficult to teach. And we had no support from the institution. And in fact, one of the things that has to happen, especially in a juvenile facility, is that the adults have to be able to practice what we teach. And they were absolutely unwilling to use any of the skills that we were teaching. So that didn't work. I taught, ended up working with a school district, Fresno Unified, the fifth largest school district in California, as they were adopting a restorative practices philosophy for their discipline. And I ended up working at a high school teaching the faculty these skills, and then ended up teaching the faculty of all the feeder middle schools. And I got phenomenal results. Teachers were writing me saying, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. My discipline problems have all gone away. So I worked for an academic year, and I never heard from the school district again. I don't know what happened. All I know is I got amazing results, at least as it was reported to me. And then the district, they ghosted me. And school districts are very difficult to work with because they are under all kinds of constraints, both time and financial. They're being pulled and tugged a million different ways, especially in this politically polarized world. Everything is political. And, you know, getting a best practices into the classroom is extremely difficult. So it works in high schools and middle schools, but it's going to take a really enlightened school board, superintendent, and principals of the middle and high schools to get behind this and really train their faculty and parents how to do this. But I'm with you, Alyssa. If this happened, we would see magic happening in our schools.
If you are enjoying this episode, please leave a 5-star review at your favorite podcast provider.
Yeah, it baffles me that you've reached, you know, such boulders trying to get this into the youth, because if we could get this into the hands and the minds of youth, this world could be a different place.
That's right. If we could teach parents, young parents, how to do all of this, which is not difficult. Like I said, it takes 46 weeks to master this at most. We wouldn't have prisons in 22 years. They'd go away. We wouldn't need them. But, you know, I've tried talking to parents about this. Young parents have no interest in this.
So if there are any parents or listeners who are interested in this, do you have online class options where they can take this? Where would they find more information on that?
So I've created a page for your audience, and the URL is Doug Noll, doug.co/success-coaching. And on that page, you can get a free ebook that describes everything that I'm talking about, tell you how to do it. You can buy my book, Deescalate. You can buy a video course on how to deescalate. It's a video course on how to calm people down. And then if you want to go deep, you can get my basic and advanced emotional competency course, which I give half off to listeners. And that really teaches the skills that I'm talking about in a very deep way. And anybody can benefit from this. Parents, teachers, coaches,
yeah,
anybody.
Well, thank you for that, because I think this is a huge tool. Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing. It's life transforming. Yeah. Thank you for that. To me, it's the foundational skill of life. And it's new. Part of the reason people haven't heard about this is because, you know, I discovered this in 2005. The Lieberman study came out in 2007. I mean, it hasn't even been 14 years. So it's still brand new. And as far as I know, I'm the only one talking about it and teaching it.
Yeah, it looks like it's being embraced, just not in California. I was on your Facebook page for your organization, and it looks like you were in Italy, or someone was in Italy.
Oh, yeah, we're all over the world. We have a startup in Italy. We have a colleague who's got Prison of Peace going in 12 prisons in Greece. Another colleague who's starting Prison of Peace in Nairobi. And because of the pandemic, of course, our in-prison programming shut down, but we took all of last year and we filmed our entire curriculum. And right now we're in post-production. We expect the entire curriculum to be available worldwide, subtitled in any language, probably in another 60 to 90 days. So anybody who has an interest of starting Prison of Peace, wherever they are, we would be targeting prisons, or other detention facilities, as well as reentry programs for people coming out of prison. And anybody can learn how to facilitate. All you have to do is facilitate the video lessons. We do all the heavy lifting in the video lessons. And what's really cool is that our trainers are all people who we trained in prison who have now been released. They're all former incarcerated students, and they are brilliant. They're brilliant.
You are making such an impact in a part of our society that tends to be forgotten.
That's correct.
That's incredible.
And, you know, the thing that, and this is even something that my Republican friends can't understand. They want to be tough on crime. But what they don't understand is, at least in California, we spend more money on our prison system, not our court system, not law enforcement, just the prison system. We spend more money on our prison system than we spend on our universities. And that's true for just about every state. So there's a cost to being tough on crime. We should be smart on crime, not tough on crime. And there's an unintended cost that people don't realize. And they complain about tax dollars being spent. And, well, they don't realize that 10% of the budget goes to the prison system.
Which is scary.
And nobody talks about it. Nobody, you can't get anybody to talk about it. So it's very hard to have a conversation around the politics and the policies of penal reform.
I'd like to go back to something you said about the lady who shared her story, the tragic story when she was young. And I've never been in prison, and I trust I never will be. That's one of my biggest fears, is going to prison for something I didn't do, like finding a body and touching it, and there I go. That's why I don't jog, because they always find the dead bodies. Yet, I'd like to go back to the point where you said she felt safer in the prison than on the streets or at home. And do you see maybe that's possibly why we have these repeat offenders? Will you ever be able to break the chain of that?
Well, recidivism is caused by a lot of different things. Some people become institutionalized, and the only place where they really feel comfortable is being in a penal institution. They've been institutionalized, and they'll never be able to live effectively anywhere else. Some people never get out of the criminal mind, and so they could just get back out and go right back to the way they were thinking. Some people, are not given proper support. You know, I mean, we got so many laws that prohibit formerly incarcerated people from getting all kinds of different jobs and licenses. I mean, it's like it's a double whammy. And so if they can't support themselves, what are they going to do? How do you make a living if you can't get a job, if you've got on your resume, I've been in prison for 25 years? I mean, what do you do? And the state gives them no support. So there are a lot of different reasons why recidivism occurs, and they're all preventable, provided you want to spend the money. But politically, people don't want to spend the money, so we suffer from that problem.
Do you see Charles Manson working with us at all? Would you like to get in the mind of him?
You know, that I never met the man, obviously, even though I was working not very far away from where he was before he died. There are... It's really hard for me to say whether or not working for somebody that notorious would be an effective student in prison of peace. The people, our students in the prisons are called to our program. They don't know why. Sometimes they hear about it and they hear how it's very rigorous and difficult and tough, and we hold people accountable, which is the first time many of them have ever been held accountable for anything. And we treat them like graduate students. Laurel and I are both adjuncts at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. And we treat them the same way we treat our graduate students. But once they get into course, assuming they get through the first workshop, typically they become fanatically loyal because they see the power of the change that occurs within them. And I mean, I've got some amazing stories about transformations that have occurred. So we have had some, I mean, we trained one of my best students was a guy who started the Aryan Brotherhood. He founded the Aryan Brotherhood back in the 1960s. He's been in prison almost his whole life. And he's got two PhDs and just an amazing human being and a very powerful mediator, super smart guy. So people like that you can work with. But if you work with, you know, somebody who's emotionally or mentally dysfunctional, they've got a dysfunction of the brain, I think that would be tough. We haven't seen too much of that.
You said you were called to their program. So is the prison selecting these people, handpicking them, or what's the process?
They self-select in. We go into a prison and we have set up an announcement that there's going to be an orientation meeting. Now, well, it's a little stricter now than it used to be. But the way we used to do it was we would have people sign up to come to an orientation meeting. They come to the meeting, and we'd get maybe 100 people in the room, usually in a gym. We'd do everything we could to dissuade them. We'd tell them how tough it is and how mean we are, because we only wanted people who were really committed. And out of that 100, we would, in the first orientation, the first time we're in a prison, we would get about 25 students, and it would whittle down to about 15. And then those 15 students ultimately became our trainers. And then once the word got out about what Prison of Peace was really all about, then we would typically have a waiting list of 200 to 300 people waiting to get into the course.
So you are giving these people the chance to make a difference in their life and change your life. It goes almost back to what you were doing. You were, you'd won every award known to man and woman as a lawyer. You, on the outside, looked like you were really happy. On the inside, it looks like you weren't that happy. And it shows, you definitely have said that. And it shows that you're never too old or too young to ever make a change when you feel it in your heart, right? It's all about emotions. And this is a prime example of how it works. I mean, you were definitely successful in your law job. And look how successful you are now, not just financially, yet the difference you're making in so many people's lives.
That's right. My life really started after 50. I mean, I really see, after I got my master's degree and left the practice of law, that's when my life really started. It took me 50 years to grow up. And my life's never been better. And I mean, like I said, we started Prison of Peace when I was 60 years old. Most people are thinking about retirement. I was just getting started.
Can you talk a little bit about how these principles can work into negotiation? I mean, we talked a little bit about who our audience is in the preamble. You know, we're talking about entrepreneurship and salespeople and that sort of thing. So maybe let's shift gears a little bit. As much as I find, I'm like Todd. One of my biggest fears is going to prison for something that crime I didn't commit or something. So
I'll just say one of our students, who one of our top trainers, was released after serving 26 years on a 30-year to life sentence, and the Innocence Project completely exonerated him. He was sentenced to prison at 14 years old. He was in the wrong. He was in the Southeast in the barrios in Los Angeles, wrong place, wrong time. Cops framed him. He got multi-million dollar settlement from the state, and now he's suing the LAPD, and he'll get a multi-million dollar settlement from them. But he spent most of his adult life in prison as a result of being wrongfully convicted. And that is a story that happens far more often than it should. But yeah, let's bring this grounding back to reality. First of all, I teach an advanced negotiation course for lawyers. Most lawyers don't know how to negotiate. And so I have been training lawyers in advanced legal negotiation since about 2010. And I also teach a course at Pepperdine called Decision Making Under Uncertainty and Conflict. So, and stress. So what do we do when we have to make a decision quickly that is monumental? And how do we make decisions when all we have in front of us are bad choices? And what are all the things that get in the way of making good decisions? So when we look in the business world, the thing that I teach people is forget about rationality. Yes, there are things called critical thinking, critical reasoning, linear processes. We can do stuff like Gantt and PERT charts for program management, project management. Those are all important. But at the end of the day, if you're leading people, you have to lead them from a place of emotional competency, not from a place of rationality. People will never respond to rational argument. That just does not motivate people. Never has, never will.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of that right now in the world, actually. You know, certainly here in Canada, certainly in the United States, certainly North America. Yeah, the rationality, it seems like that the rational argument just is completely ignored.
It is.
Right? Yeah.
And that's because we are emotional beings. But, well, there are a lot of reasons why it's gotten really bad. The polarization has gotten bad. Mostly, in my opinion, it's because of the collapse of our educational system over the last 30 years. Right now, for example, in California, 80% of the college students are women. Men are not going to college. Why is that? Well, everybody's scratching their heads. It's because our educational system has failed young men. But now you're in business. You got your own business. You've got a startup, or you're leading a small company, or maybe you're leading a large company, or maybe you're a divisional vice president or something like that. And you're wondering, why is my team dysfunctional? How do I manage this remote team? I've got these 20 somethings and I'm having a hell of a time herding them. It's like, I can't get them motivated. I can't get anything done. And, you know, they're as absent as they are present. Start thinking about them as emotional beings, not as rational beings. And start thinking about, what are their emotional experiences? Are they frustrated? Are they bored? Are they, you know, and during the pandemic when we're, you know, isolated and, you know, we're closed in and can't go out and can't socialize, think about the emotional stresses that are on your people and start thinking at them as emotional people. And then be thinking about, all right, I've got to relate to them at an emotional level, not at a logical, rational business level. And a lot of business people that I run across that I coach say, I don't want to do that. And I said, then you're going to fail. Remember, being a leader is not about doing. Being a leader is about being. It's your beingness that makes you a leader, not who you are, not how you became a leader, not your education, not your MBA or your PhD or whatever you got. It's about how you are as a human being is what makes you a leader. And leaders provide three fundamental psychological things to a group: focus, direction, and safety. And to the degree that people who are entrepreneurs don't get that, and they believe in the old command and control stuff, you do it because I write the paychecks, or I'm the boss, or I'm the guy that created this, they're going to fail, pure and simple. And they do. You know, with the Harvard Business Review came out with a study a month ago, very recently, that 2 out of 5 leaders, CEOs, fail within 18 months of taking their job. Why? Because they're not being trained in the right things. And you won't get this training in business school, because business professors, just like professors of education, they're under this academic stricture of publish or perish. And it's very difficult to publish articles about emotions and emotional development and emotional competency. And you can't do a lot of research around it, because now you're going outside your area of finance or quantitative analysis, wandering into social psychology and neuroscience, which is forbidden in academia. God, heaven forbid we be multidisciplinary experts. You know, I mean, and so again, it's a failure of our educational system.
So obviously you think that emotional intelligence can be taught.
Actually, no. I claim that emotional intelligence can't be taught. And this is a big myth perpetrated by Daniel Goleman and his people. And because emotional intelligence is a test, just like IQ or Watson-Glaser critical thinking test, it's a test. You can't teach a test. What you teach are the competencies that allow somebody to score high on an emotional intelligence test. So you've got to learn the competencies. You can learn the competencies, but you can't learn the test. So when people are out there saying, come take our emotional intelligence course, I just shake my head. These people obviously have not studied the literature and don't understand this stuff. And I've, you know, last time I looked, I think there were over 340 different online organizations offering some kind of emotional intelligence training. And I just, as I skimmed through them, their teachers did not have any significant credentials, and there was nothing on any of the websites that I visited that showed that the teachers themselves were emotionally competent. How can you teach something you're not? And this is another, we've all heard of core curriculum, and part of core curriculum, the core curriculum movement, is socio-emotional learning in the classroom. How can a teacher teach socio-emotional learning when the teachers themselves are emotionally incompetent? You know, people don't even think about these basic foundational things. But yes, you can increase your ability to score high on an emotional intelligence test by learning how to be emotionally self-aware, learn how to emotionally self-regulate, and learn cognitive and affective empathy. And these are all skills that can be taught and learned and mastered. It's not an
so these are so then these would then be the skills that you would coach top level CEO that is on the right. On the cusp of potentially failing out as that CEO.
That's right. And I would make it even easier than that, because if I teach you cognitive empathy, one skill, affect labeling, then you will automatically develop emotional self-awareness and emotional self-regulation. All you have to do is be able to read somebody else's emotions and label them, and you will automatically increase your own emotional competency. And it happens every single time without fail. I mean, again, look at the Prison Project. Look what we've been able to do there with people who were so far gone that society gave up on them. And yet they have turned out to be some of the most powerful, brilliant peacemakers I've ever experienced. It's the same thing in business.
So reading someone's emotional level is different than reading their body language, correct?
Reading their emotions is different than
reading their body language.
Well, yes and no. When we read emotional data, think about emotions as being data. It's no different than what you see on a spreadsheet. It's just a different form of data. 58% of the data, emotional data, is communicated through the face, facial expressions, primarily through eye movements. About roughly 38% is communicated through nonverbal tonality, volume, speed, and timbre of your voice. And only 7% of emotional information is communicated by content, the words themselves. So our brains are hardwired to read facial expressions and listen to nonverbal sound. And from that, read, assimilate, interpret, and correctly understand the emotional experience of another human being. Now, the problem is that most families are emotionally dysfunctional, 95%, according to Virginia Satir. And that means that they're developing emotionally incompetent adults. So these skills are not, of course, are not taught or learned in families because families don't know how to do this. In fact, the opposite happens. Children are emotionally invalidated. Now, let me give you a quick example. Remember when you remember when you're 2 years old or 3 years old and you're out running around having a good time, you fall over, skin your knee, and you start to cry. It hurts. You're scared. What are you told?
Suck it up.
Suck it up. Rub dirt on it. It doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
Put on your big girl panties. Don't be a girly girl. Don't be a big man. Don't cry. We were told this throughout childhood and all the way through adults that to have emotions is evil, weak, and bad. So actually it's called emotional invalidation. And in my opinion, it is the most insidious, pervasive form of emotional abuse that exists. It's everywhere. And research shows that it destroys the proper development of a human brain. And yet we do this all the time. And so if we want emotionally healthy people, then we have to learn how to validate emotions, not invalidate them. We have to learn how to be present with other people's emotionality, which means we have to learn how to manage our own anxiety that naturally arises when other people are upset, angry, or intensely emotional. And these are all skills that we have to learn. Fortunately, it's very easy to master this stuff, but we just have to have the right teacher and the right information, and then we can do it. Again, I can train a murderer to be a peacemaker. Imagine what I could do with you.
Where do you see this going in the future? Do you see it becoming something that isn't taught in schools, in colleges, a curriculum?
I hope that I can reach enough people with what time I have remaining in my life to create enough of a ripple that this just continues to grow and grow and grow and grow. And more research is done in the area. There's more science to support this work, that we get away from the old pop psychology BS that has enslaved us for so many years. And we really start doing empirically based work. And as more and more people become in touch with their emotions, become emotionally competent, they become stronger thinkers. They become better decision makers. They become better human beings overall. And this just spreads.
Thank you so much for the website that you gave us. If you could repeat that for us one more time, and then also tell us where else we can get more information and where your books are available, because this podcast is fascinating. I think more people need to dig further into what you're trying to create for our future generations.
Yes, dougnoel.co/success-coaching. That will also get you on to the rest of my website, which is dougnoel.com, not .co. And on that website, I've got over 100 blogs that discuss all of these topics in great detail. And I also have a YouTube channel. If you just do Douglas Noel YouTube, you get on my YouTube channel, and you'll see me talking about a lot of this stuff on a lot of different topics. And there's another channel that my wife and I have called Empath.Help that YouTube channel. And if you go to that channel and you happen to be, if you know what I'm, if you, you'll know what I'm talking about, if you hear this, if you're empathically sensitive or you're a highly sensitive person, we have videos there that can be useful. And there's also a lot of good stuff for people who want to get insights into working with themselves. And we talk a lot about emotions in those YouTubes. My books are available in all the usual places and mainstream. They're all mainstream. So, but the book that I think would be of most interest to people is my fourth book, Deescalate. The other books are more academic. And you can find me, easily find me on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever good books are sold. You'll find the books.
Okay, I'm ordering paperbacks of the books. It's required reading now in my house. Get off the bloody devices.
Can you ever create empathy if you lack it in your life?
Sure. It's a skill.
I've been working on it forever, and I...
That's because nobody has ever told you what empathy really is. Think of it this way. The way we're taught about empathy is we're given empathy as a caring point of view. We got to care about people.
Which I do.
Of course, we all do. But that doesn't give you a skill set that allows you to actually be empathic. And in business, it's even tougher because you're going to run across people that you really don't like. And how do you care for somebody you really don't like? And if you're a leader or an entrepreneur in a business and you've got an organization, you can't possibly care for everybody, because if you do, you're going to come across as inauthentic and fake. So this caring point of view makes no sense whatsoever. It's wrong. The right way to think about empathy is from an informational point of view. Think of empathy as the ability to read, assimilate, interpret, and reflect back the emotions of another human being accurately, effectively, and quickly. And when you are able to do that, that's the definition of cognitive empathy. When you are able to do that, you can touch that person at a very deep level, demonstrating from the speaker's frame of reference that you understand exactly what their emotional experience is. And you can do it for a group as well as for individuals. And that is a skill that can be taught and mastered. So when you think about empathy as simply learning how to manage the data of emotions, emotional data, then it becomes something that we can get our head around. And it's something that we can learn and master and measure. But as long as we stay in this old pop psychology crap, it's just fuzzy, which is why business people don't like it. It's too touchy-feely. I have a lot of thoughts around that, but it just becomes too incoherent and difficult to understand. But once you crystallize it down to the science, it becomes very manageable and very usable as a skill.
I just love what you're doing. I mean, it's great to finally see something good. Unfortunately, it seems like many people may be threatened by how good it is. And it's going to possibly change the entire educational system, the entire prison system. And I think it's a lot of fear-based, the what ifs. This does take off and it changes what we've done before.
Well, I appreciate being here, especially with talented people like the three of you, because you influence a lot of people. Your clientele, are highly influential people. And as coaches, you master these skills and then start teaching these skills to your clients. And that's the ripple effect. It's not going to come from some massive, big movement. It's going to come from people learning these skills one by one, experiencing what they will experience without a doubt, and then becoming motivated to teach the skills to the people that they know. And it just spreads outward like a ripple. And that's why I do so many podcasts. Is every now and then I hope I get on a show where somebody listens to what I'm talking about and a light bulb goes on and they take it and they run with it. And that's how we're going to get this out there.
Oh, you've got me sold. And Kelly apparently has already bought like 14 courses already during this podcast.
Maybe.
And maybe. It's in Canadian dollars, so he's going to have to like remortgage the entire house.
Yeah, I already did. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, amazing.
Thanks for listening to Gain the Passion. Please rate, review, and share the podcast. And don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button.